Okay, good afternoon. And my name is Pok Thiravit Chainan. I'm a sociologist and social demographer. I'm also associate professor of sociology at School of Social Sciences at Singapore Management University. Unlike many people here, I don't have any direct connections to LSE. This is my first time visiting the university. But I have the privilege of working with many people who are trained at LSE. Okay, so this panel addresses one of the hot button issues in the region, which is inclusion and exclusion. So as a sociologist, I tend to think that this theme, the theme of this panel, speaks to the central questions that many, that sort of driving many researchers in social sciences. So the question is who gets what and why? Or the flip side of it is who doesn't get what and why? So the four panelists will address the questions of who are included and excluded in this region. On what basis are they included and excluded? Socioeconomic status, political or religious affiliation, citizenship status, or ethnicity? And what are the mechanisms, particularly the institutional mechanism, through which groups of individuals are included and excluded in this region? So the four panelists will address these questions in the context of Malaysia, Philippines, Indonesia, and Laos. So the first speaker, Dr. Catherine Allerton, is based at LSE, and she's a specialist in anthropology of island Southeast Asia. She has extensive research experience in Indonesia and East Malaysia. Her talk will touch upon the lives of children of migrants, Filipino and Indonesian migrants in East Malaysia. The second speaker is Dr. Augusto Gatmaitan, who was trained as a lawyer as well as anthropologist. He received his doctoral degree in anthropology from LSE. He's currently a faculty member at the Ateneo de Davao University in the Philippines. He also co-founded an NGO that provides free legal services to indigenous people of the Philippines. So today he will share with us his work on indigenous rights in Mindanao. The third speaker is Dr. Alice Na, who is a human rights expert based at the University of York. Dr. Na conducts extensive research on human rights defenders at risk and asylum in Asia, and she will share with us her research on the security and protection of human rights defender in Indonesia. So our last speaker, this panel is quite special because we have more speakers. Our last speaker is Julio Ongaro, who's a doctoral student in anthropology at LSE. As part of his PhD research, he spent the last 2 years living with Akha community in Laos. And so today he will share his findings on his research on Akha identity in Laos. So without further delay, I would like to invite Dr. Allerton to give her paper here.
Okay, so I don't know if I'm... Oh, there we go. In this panel, we'll explore the stories of those living at the margins in Southeast Asia, those whose stories disrupt conventional accounts of inclusiveness and national unity, and those whose situations present some uncomfortable issues and questions about inequality and human rights. So let me begin with Malaysia. As we all know, Malaysia is one of the economic success stories of Southeast Asia. But this development comes at a cost. And in this talk, I want to give a glimpse of the costs of Malaysia's growth for one particular group of people. And these are children born to migrants and refugees in the East Malaysian state of Sabah. Am I pointing it in the right direction?
Yes.
Okay, so Sabah, in the north of the island of Borneo, has a long history of movements and migration. Many ethnic groups in this region, also known as the Sulu Zone, straddle contemporary political boundaries. But in the 1970s and 80s, these movements intensified. First of all, you had up to 100,000 refugees coming from the southern Philippines because of the secessionist war in the southern Philippines and arriving in Sabah and being given the right to remain in Sabah, but a kind of temporary right to remain. And then they were followed by hundreds of thousands of economic migrants, also from the southern Philippines, but particularly from mostly rural areas of eastern Indonesia. Today, foreign workers and their dependents may account for up to 40% of Sabah's population of about 3 to 4 million. But in fact, this is almost impossible to know. Undocumented people are incredibly hard to count. And whenever a proper estimate is made, often the figures are kind of sat on because they're too politically divisive. So the Malaysian migration regime that these migrants initially encountered was relatively relaxed. But since the 1990s, there's been increasing regulation and securitization. And public discourse in Sabah in particular is strongly anti-migrant for all kinds of political reasons. So my current work draws on a year of ethnographic research I conducted with the children of migrants and refugees in Kota Kinabalu, the capital of Sabah, also known as KK. And these children are an extremely heterogeneous population. For those of you interested, the children of Filipino origin are Suluk, Bajau, Yakan, Ubiang, Cagayan. The children of Indonesian origin are from Tanah Toraja, they're Bugis, they're Bhutanese, and they're called Timor, which are people from the East Flores region. And what I'm interested in are the ways in which these children's lives are profoundly influenced by migration processes and regulations, even though most of them have never migrated themselves. So migrant workers in Malaysia are supposed to be a fluid labour force. They're supposed to move in and out of the country according to demand. They're not allowed to bring, if they're unskilled or semi-skilled workers, they are not allowed to bring dependents with them into Malaysia. They are not supposed to marry or have families in the state. So even though Sabah depends on migrant labour, the state accepts no responsibility for the costs of the social reproduction of that labour. These children who I worked with are mostly born in Sabah, but they are considered foreign. And therefore, they have really unique perspectives on inclusion and exclusion. For example, if we think about how migrations are often represented, here's a classic cartographic representation of migration from Indonesia to Malaysia, where arrows represent the flows of migrants across borders. And you can see that migration into Sabah is a very different migration route to that into Peninsular Malaysia. But despite what someone said in the previous panel in terms of maps being, you know, wonderful representations of ideas, maps are deeply problematic. These kinds of depictions of migration can be criticized for failing to represent the reality of cross-border flows, of movements back and forth, and for contributing to hysterical discourses about floods of migrants arriving in a country. And more significantly, they don't represent any kind of reality for the children I work with. So I'm interested in what kind of map might represent such a reality. And during my fieldwork, one of my methodological tools was to ask children to draw a road of their life. This is where you draw a big road, and at one end of the road, you're born, and the other end of the road is you now. And along the way, you draw and write about significant places, people, events in your life. And this is the road of Herman, who's an 11-year-old Suluk boy. And at first, his road confused me because it wasn't a road, it was a map. And it didn't really depict any biographical events. But what his road does is to map out a landscape of places relevant to his life in KK, places that he annotates with brief descriptions. The hospital where I was born, the beach where I once went, the first place I lived in Lane 5, the police station in Mengatal where my father was detained. It's a map of ongoing engagements with the city as a home, but also a place of exclusion. So the children of migrants in KK inhabit lives that are sometimes visible to Malaysian citizens, but that are mostly hidden away. They live in workers' housing attached to factories or farms, often called rumah kongsi, and they live in houses in squatter villages on the edges of the city. And all of the rest of the photos I'm going to show are photos taken by the children I worked with. The photo on the left was taken for me by one boy, 10-year-old Jerry. When I asked him to describe his photo, he said, "We live in the mangrove trees. There's lots of rubbish and it smells. Our house has fallen into the water 4 times. And this photo was also taken by Jerry. It shows a small boat that shuttles people across a little stretch of water into the mangroves, into the squatter village inside the mangroves. And in journeying on this boat, children cross a particular kind of border. It's a border between the public world of the city and the hidden spaces and informal economy of an undocumented life. Most of the children I knew are undocumented. Many of them are the grandchildren of Filipino refugees. They lack any kind of identification papers, whether Filipino or Malaysian. they are strongly at risk of statelessness. And their illegality involves constant exclusions and ongoing fear of what's known locally as checking. As you probably know, in Malaysia, you have to carry with you a valid identification card or pass, and you can be stopped at any moment, anywhere, by a police officer or immigration officer who can ask to see this. And if you do not have valid identification papers, and particularly if you look foreign, you can be detained. So under these conditions, children become very concerned with whether or not they have a pass. This is Marilyn, a 12-year-old Suluk girl, who wrote this about her kind of life without a pass. She says, you know, if you don't have a pass, you're scared of the police and you're scared of going out. And what's interesting is she says, you know, one day if I'm lucky, I can get a pass. Being undocumented has no moral connotations for these children. Not having a pass, they don't see it as making you illegal. It's just something you're lucky enough to have or unlucky enough not to have. So children born to migrants in Sabah were previously entitled to attend Malaysian primary schools. But since 1999, foreigner has been stamped on the birth certificates of such children. And since 2002, Malaysian schools have refused to accept foreign children. Of course, many people who are undocumented don't even have birth certificates, so they would never have a chance of going to schools anyway. And just to give you a sense of how profound this educational exclusion is, during my fieldwork, I conducted a survey with about 140 working teenagers working in little shops and cafes around the city. And for those teenagers, the average length of any form of education they had ever had was 2 months. So many of them had never had any kind of education. These days, the only forms of learning that are available, with the exception of one formal Indonesian school, Sekolah Indonesia Kota Kinabalu, in the city, the only other forms of education available are through charitable learning centres, but these offer only basic education. And it's interesting that Malaysia has ratified the Convention on the Rights of the Child, but it maintains various reservations, including a reservation on Article 28.1a on free and compulsory primary education. So in all kinds of ways, we can say that these children are excluded from Malaysia. They are treated as illegal immigrants, even though they've never migrated. They are at risk of arrest, detention, and deportation. They are unable to attend government schools or to access low-cost healthcare. However, exclusion is not the whole picture. And in my work at the moment, in my writing at the moment, I'm very influenced by those scholars writing on undocumented migrants, particularly the sans-papiers in France, and the Dreamer movement in the US, who try to write about the differential inclusion of undocumented migrants, or people who try to theorize non-citizenship in ways that don't follow a simple binary opposition with citizenship. So although these children are strongly stigmatized, or they are excluded in various ways, they are also, of course, included in other kinds of ways. And I think it's really important, almost as a way to write against and argue against the idea that they are foreign and therefore necessarily excluded, to talk about the ways that they're included. Most positively, these children all speak Malay. They don't just speak Malay, they speak Sabahan Malay, which has a very distinctive kind of dialect. They are part of strong community networks, and they're involved with distinctively Sabahan cultural traditions, including religious practice. This is a photo on the left of a bunch of children at a wedding party watching the rather spectacular transvestite dancer on the right. And this is part of a whole cross-border culture of kind of Sulug wedding performers who move between Sabah and the southern Philippines. So this is one particular kind of transnational culture that children are really fascinated by and that's very connected to life in Sabah. Children are, of course, also included through the forms of work they do. Here on the left is 12-year-old Malik working on a market stall selling ABC drinks, and 11-year-old Thomas working collecting eggs in a chicken farm. And many of the children I knew worked at these kinds of jobs alongside studying at learning centres. Others had never been to school but worked in brick factories or chicken farms on the edge of the city. And this kind of inclusion through work, is of course also seen amongst undocumented adults, who, even as they are treated as expendable illegals, also continue to be constantly employed in the state's restaurants, factories, oil palm plantations, and construction sites. But this form of inclusion is, of course, a precarious and vulnerable form of inclusion, since, as one author, Mei Ngai, has put it, writing about impossible subjects in the US, such workers end up constituting a proletariat outside the polity. Finally, children are also included in the state of Saba because of their family histories of entanglement with the places of the state. And this is a photo taken by one Suluk girl as part of a project of taking photos of her life that I find very profound. What does it mean to be considered a foreigner, even though your parents were also born in Saba and your grandparents are buried in Saba's soil? So these children's lives and their exclusions and inclusions pose very difficult questions about migrant rights and about child rights in an interconnected Southeast Asia and in a context where human rights are so dependent on being a citizen of a particular nation state. And I look forward to discussing them further in the questions. Thank you.
Good afternoon, everyone. I'd like to begin by thanking the organizers for considering me for being included in this panel and for this inaugural forum of the Southeast Asia program of LSE. My paper is entitled The Perils of Exclusion and Inclusion, Indigenous Rights in Mindanao. On 30 August 2015, a group of 40 government soldiers and paramilitary auxiliaries arrived in Hanayan, an indigenous Manobo community in the hinterland of Liangatown in the southern Philippines. The paramilitary unit was known as the Bagani, Bagahat group, composed mainly of Manobo recruits. They set up quarters in the function hall and school grounds of Alcadev. Alcadev is an award-winning government-regulated school set up in Hanayan to provide education to Manobos in remote areas of the Philippines. Shortly after their arrival, the armed force burned down the cooperative store of Mapasu. Mapasu is the community association of the Manobos in that area. Through the next day, 31 August, they searched for officials of Mapasu and of the staff of the Alcadev, all the while harassing community residents. The executive director of Alcadev, Emerito Samarca, was detained and bound. Some residents started evacuating the village, setting out on foot to a neighboring community known as Kilometer 16. About half of the armed men who had arrived in Hanayan followed the escapees to Kilometer 16. At around 4 a.m. of September 1, the people of Kilometer 16, as well as the evacuees from Hanayan, were roused from sleep by the armed men and ordered to gather at the community center. Junel Campos, the chairperson of the Mapasu, community leader Aurelio Sinzo, and Belen Italo, a member of the Alcadev's teaching staff, were singled out and forced to sit in front of the assembled villagers. Then two of the paramilitary troops, who were both Manobo, shot and killed Campos and Sinzo and seriously wounded Italo in full view of the assembly. The evacuees from Hanayan who returned to their village later the following morning discovered the dead body of Samarca, the director of the school, in one of the school rooms. His throat had been cut from ear to ear. The military has denied responsibility for the incident. Its spokespersons even countered that the Alcadev was simply a breeding ground for communist rebels. In a congressional hearing on the incident, for example, the military presented a certain Datu Jomar Bocales, who testified that Samarca had to be killed because he, quote, poisoned the people, unquote, against the government. I argue that this series of incidents is indicative of the situation of many indigenous groups in the Philippines today. I am not saying that all indigenous communities have suffered military or paramilitary abuses in the way that people of Hanayan did. I do believe, on the other hand, that this case draws together a number of issues that all Philippine indigenous communities contend with today. The rather extreme but certainly not unique experience of the people of Hanayan merely brings these issues more sharply into focus. I turn now to explore some of these issues. The first is marginalization. Like most other indigenous communities, the Manobos of Hanayan are marginalized, historically linked to remote, vote-poor uplands and hinterlands of rural towns and provinces. This spatial marginalization, of course, translates into economic marginalization as the lack of road infrastructure and transport facilities limit access to the market and to needed social services. Thus, even as the Philippines has reported an economic growth rate of 6.2% for 2015, there are large areas in the hinterlands where this development has simply not trickled down. One grim indicator of this economic exclusion is what one military officer, speaking in 2015, called the Lumadization of the insurgency, the ethnification of the profile, or the demographic profile of the New People's Army or the communist insurgency. He explained that 3 out of every 4 insurgents in Mindanao today are members of indigenous peoples, suggesting that poverty and social discontent is highest in that sector. The Manobo of Hanayan see education as a key to escaping this same poverty. Unfortunately, the remoteness of many of their communities puts them beyond the reach of the educational system. One source estimates that in Mindanao, 9 out of every 10 children from indigenous communities do not have access to schools. And it was this very same desire to ensure the education of their children that prompted Mapasu to work with Alcadev and set up the school in Hanayan. The irony here is that Hanayan's attempt to transcend its economic exclusion through alternative schooling has been the cause of its suspicion by the military and the paramilitary. We have already noted that the military have accused Alcadev of being a training ground for communist insurgents. This is, I think, a Philippine variation on a political theme that characterizes state attitudes towards indigenous groups across Southeast Asia. A drive to bring development to the indigenous peoples on the margins, framed in particular in terms of demands that indigenous peoples conform to state-defined requirements for membership in the national polity. Elsewhere in Southeast Asia, these requirements consist of membership in a world religion, for example, or loyalty to the king. In the Philippines, this requirement for recognition as citizens seems to be conformity to the state's economic policies. That is to say, the Philippine state's drive for development is so deep-seated that people who do not embrace it are deemed suspect in terms of their loyalty to the state. This is problematic for indigenous peoples who are wary of losing any more of their lands and resources to mining and other ventures sponsored by the state and its economic policies. Mapasu, in particular, has been very vocal in its opposition to mining. And as a result, and as we have seen, they are accused of being supporters of the communist insurgency. I do not discount, of course, the economic aspect of the state's attitude towards these marginalized peoples. I believe, however, that there is more to the matter than this. More particularly, I would consider the alternative nature of the Alcadev School. By definition, being alternative marks the school as different from those other schools run according to the standards of the state. And they are thus that much easier to tag as communist. The point is that the state is interested not just in mining, but in the very allegiance of indigenous peoples. In the case of Hanayan, their resort to an alternative school makes them additionally suspect, as this suggests a rejection of the state's educational system, the values it espouses, and by extension, the Philippine state itself. Never mind that the same state failed to extend educational services to this area in the first place. This makes the assertion of self-determination, the right to choose a course other than that dictated by the state, deeply problematic for indigenous peoples in the Philippines. A final issue I would like to sketch out here is the impact of this state's braided demands for economic and symbolic compliance on indigenous peoples. Faced with the demands of the state, indigenous groups have taken various approaches and communities have become divided, with various groups adopting different, sometimes contradictory stances and tactics. In the case of Hanayan, there is a clear divide between those who worked for the establishment of the Alcadev School on one hand and those who targeted that same school for violence. The latter group, I surmise, have decided that the best way to deal with the pressures from the state is by joining the state, literally by becoming part of the paramilitary units of the Philippine state. The other group seems to be trying to keep the Philippine state at a distance. They have maintained a critical attitude towards the state's policy, favoring foreign investments in the mining industry. And in the face of the consequent violence, They have experience at the hands of the state's military. They have developed a critical attitude towards the state itself. I'm not saying that all indigenous indigenous peoples in Hanayan are all polarized as either for or against the state. I am more inclined to think that people would take differing and even shifting positions along a continuum of possible responses to the state. In the process, however, cultural resources may be deployed to legitimize their respective positions. The paramilitaries, for example, refer to themselves as Bagani, or warriors, invoking the traditional role of protector of the Manobo community. My informants, on the other hand, decry this as a distortion of the warrior's true role, which is to fight for the community and not to serve as a minion of an alien and intrusive state. In conclusion, I am not saying that all indigenous peoples in the Philippines occupy the same fraught space that the Manobo occupy today. I do assert that all groups, however, contend with the issues of economic and political marginalization, with the demands of the state for their allegiance, and with the social and political consequences of their various responses to those same demands. This is an attempt to follow the growing literature in exploring and trying to understand the state from the perspective of those at its margins, in this case, indigenous peoples. Its particular emphasis is on the role of violence, or the possibility thereof, in the negotiation of state-indigenous peoples' relations. Where the violence has become pervasive, as is the case in Hanayan, people live in day-to-day terror. Our understanding of the state must reconcile the reality of this violence and terror with the modern institutions of governance and democracy which dominate our imaginings of the state. It is this dual character of the state, civil and uncivil, in varying degrees and in varying times, that frames the day-to-day life of indigenous peoples in the Philippines. I think the data on which I'm basing my paper requires that we problematize the character of development itself. We've come to look at development or inclusive development or inclusive growth as something like a unqualified good. No? But for indigenous peoples, they require or they demand that we analyze the character of these development projects and ask whether or not these are acceptable to indigenous peoples. We also need to problematize the entanglement of development as a program of the state with the state's own centralizing projects demanding compliance on the part of indigenous peoples. And finally, I think there is a need for a conversation on how the right of self-determination of indigenous peoples has to be realized in a context driven by a politics of exclusions and inclusions. Thank you very much.
Hi, everyone. It's a pleasure to be with you here today and also to speak at this panel, which touches on a lot of issues which I think are really important for us to consider as we think about life in Southeast Asia, both now and in the future. My presentation will focus on three parts. Well, first of all, I'll speak a bit about who human rights defenders are, and then ask this question: what is protection in the human rights framework? Who protects and how? And then share with you a little bit about my current research that looks at how human rights defenders navigate risks, manage security, and receive protection support. This is part of a study that looks at 5 countries, so I'm sharing with you in this presentation the data that comes out of Indonesia. So first of all, who is a human rights defender? The 1998 Declaration on Human Rights Defenders states that everyone has the right, individually and in association with others, to promote and to strive for the protection and realization of human rights and fundamental freedoms at the national and international levels. Human rights defenders are not just activists or NGO staff. They come from all sectors of society and backgrounds. They could be wives, mothers, daughters. They could be students, journalists, trade unionists, doctors, teachers, social workers, they could be indigenous people, farmers, villagers, They could be from the state apparatus as well, the police or judges, government officials or ministers. You might be a human rights defender if you promote and you protect human rights. A lot of us can work on human rights in relative safety, but there are some human rights defenders who are threatened and attacked, imprisoned, even killed for their work, and thus they need to be protected. Protection is the key concept in international relations and in the human rights regime. States are the main duty bearer. States have the duty to protect the rights and security of people and people against human rights abuses by third parties, such as corporations, criminal gangs, and other private actors. Over the past two decades, states and civil society groups have been investing in developing an international regime for the protection of human rights defenders at risk. This protection regime derives its principles and norms from the international human rights regime, and it adopts a human security paradigm, with individuals, groups, and communities as a referent of security rather than states. Protection actors in this regime, states, civil society groups, donors, and so on, recognize that their efforts to strengthen the protection of defenders should complement the efforts that defenders themselves take for their own security. However, there's very little research that examines exactly how defenders navigate the risks they face, manage their security, and receive protection support. Every context is different, every country is different, and the perpetrators and the risks that defenders face are therefore different. Experiences of risk vary depending on the type of human rights work they do, the geographical location of their work, and the acceptability of their work to the broader public. A more conventional understanding of human rights work focuses on civil and political rights, focuses on state actors such as the police and military as perpetrators. But social, cultural, and religious norms also result in threats and attacks against defenders. In Aceh, for example, the implementation of Sharia laws results in the public caning of men and women on a range of practices, such as being in close proximity with a person of the opposite sex with whom they're not married, for adultery, for practicing homosexuality, for gambling or drinking alcohol. Defenders who speak up about these issues risk being stigmatized as being anti-Islamic. LGBTI people are marginalized and stigmatized. LGBT groups and defenders of LGBTI rights are very vulnerable to violence from vigilante groups, the police, and unknown perpetrators. Religious minorities are attacked by regular people, non-state actors. What are the obligations of a state in such acts? How do you hold the state accountable for these acts of violence? Should we rethink how protection is conceptualized and put into practice? This research that I'm talking about is based on semi-structured interviews and surveys with defenders in five countries, Colombia, Mexico, Egypt, Kenya, and Indonesia. And they are conducted by researchers located in these countries, and they focus on vernacular or everyday understandings of security. And what have we found in the case of Indonesia? We find that defenders in Indonesia have adopted a number of practices for managing their security. This includes restricting activities such as changing their routines, changing travel routes, being careful about what they say in public, choosing not to participate in some activities that may endanger them, being very aware of the surroundings, being very aware of monitoring and surveillance that goes on. It includes planning ahead before key events, choosing which defenders will have a more visible advocacy role while keeping others less visible, maintaining contact with networks for urgent actions and advocacy. It includes strengthening the capacity of victim groups to face the risks that they face so that they are strengthened and more able to withstand the pressures that they're under. When asked about their security, worries about the safety of family members is a strong theme. Perpetrators also threaten and target family members. But some defenders face threats from their own family as well and their own community members, in particular those who challenge social, cultural, and religious norms. Women human rights defenders, LGBTI defenders, defenders acting on community issues where the victim and perpetrator are from the same community, they are particularly vulnerable. Social networks, we find, are fundamental to protection. Networks facilitate the provision of protection support for defenders and increase the recognition given to defenders. We find that the stronger and deeper the relationships between different protection actors, the more swiftly they can react and coordinate their actions to protect defenders at risk. We also find that there are different types of social networks. There's a lot of literature on transnational advocacy networks, networks that connect local actors with international NGOs and sympathetic states. But there are also local networks and community forms of protection. A woman defender in Maluku, for example, says, "In Maluku, gandong is the key. This is brotherhood system in which you must protect your gandong, your brothers and sisters. So if I say I'm from this gandong, this clan, then they will know which bloodlines I'm connected to. So they will not only do any harm on me, but they have an obligation to protect me." When we ask defenders what factors make you feel secure, they say having the support of neighbours, community members and fellow defenders is important. This includes protecting them physically, being a source of information and early warning system, and being a source of social and psychological support. I mentioned earlier that states and civil society groups have been investing in building a protection regime for human rights defenders at risk. While this is important, we also see that many protection practices are very resource dependent. Relocation, accompaniment, legal defense, cameras, bodyguards, all of these cost money. And there are inequalities in the way that protection resources are being distributed or being made available globally. The extent to which defenders are connected, respected, and knowledgeable affects their enjoyment of protection initiatives. Those who are more isolated, whose work is disrespected or stigmatized, and who have less knowledge about strategies, tactics, and resources are less likely to benefit from protection initiatives and are more vulnerable as a result. We also find that the term human rights defender and human rights are contested terms. It is familiar only to some activists in the mainstream human rights circles. In some contexts, such as Aceh, human rights is perceived very negatively as representing Western values. Those who defend their rights are also stigmatized. They are cast as anti-government, acting against the state, separatists, and some are reviled by their own communities for challenging cultural and religious norms. Importantly, when institutions don't recognize that everyone has the right to defend their rights and to defend the rights of others, and when they don't understand or recognize the issues that defenders are advocating for, they don't protect them. One of our respondents said, for example, that who's an LGBTI rights defender, says that the National Commission of Human Rights and the Anti-Violence Against Women National Commission recognizes LGBTI rights, but not the Witnesses and Victims Protection Agency. In summary, as in the rest of the world, the security and protection of human rights defenders in Indonesia depends on whether they're recognized as rights holders and whether their right to defend their own rights is protected by the state and by the international community. Thank you.
Oh, hello, thank you everyone. So we're talking about the Aka in Laos. My research focus was actually on traditional medicine and shamanism, but I thought I might say something about identity as well. So the Aka population of about 500,000 people, they're originally from China, but in the last 2 or 3 centuries they have migrated south and they're now found within the nation borders of 5 states. And they are Burma, the northern Thailand, China, tip of Vietnam, and northern Laos, where they number around 90,000 people in Laos now. They are historically, like other upland groups, they have always tried to stay away from state coercion and to avoid things like slavery and taxation. And in the process, they have developed a society that in many ways is opposite to that of lowland society. They are shifty cultivation, they don't have permanent rice fields. They are animist, not Buddhist. They are oral, they don't have a writing system. They are egalitarian, they're not hierarchical. They're often portrayed as anarchists. And their higher political unit is the village. And the important thing to say about Aka identity is that it's not tied to a particular geographic location. They're not indigenous in this respect, but they're based on carrying a heavy tradition of customs that's been handed down by the ancestors. And these customs are really all-encompassing. They permeate every social domain of life, from how to work in the land, how to dress, this is what the Aka look like, how to build a house, they regulate kinship relations, it's a bigger family, and especially they regulate how to perform rituals like this. One thing to say about Aka identity is that they have a performative idea of it. In other words, one is what one does. And so you are Aka. Being Aka means doing all these Aka-specific things and carry all these Aka-specific customs. So if one Aka at a certain point takes on Lao custom, then from an Aka perspective, it becomes Lao. At the same point, if I go to an Aka village and I start practicing Aka custom, then I become Aka. In fact, I became a bit of Aka. And another thing to say, to highlight about this idea of identity, is that it developed in a pre-modern context of dispersion of unequal power relations with the lowland and in a context of autonomy, at a time when the lowland state did not have full control over the highlands. And really, Aka customs, especially rituals, reflect this idea of this pre-modern context of autonomy. Most rituals are about maintaining and demarcating a boundary between a dominion of inside, which is the domain of where the Aka live and where the ancestors live, and a dangerous domain of the outside, where both Laolanders and evil spirits live. And some anthropologists have gone as far as saying that Aka do not make a distinction between humans and spirits, but between beings of the inside, whether Aka or ancestors, and beings of the outside, whether Lowlanders or evil spirits. And so, for example, this is one of the rituals they do. The children are dressed as spirits, and they roam about the village during the day, and then they're kicked out of the village at night as a way of, again, affirming the autonomy of the inside sphere of the village. Okay, this is another build. And also they build gates, again, as a symbolic protection from the lowland. They stick guns on top as to threaten external forces. Now, in 2016, this collective idea of identity is no longer found in Southeast Asia, except in some remote areas of Laos, like where I did my fieldwork. But even here, it's being challenged by new policies of integration and development. In Laos, since 1975, when the new socialist government came into power, the state launched a campaign to include all ethnic groups within the national fold. And this in Laos has never been easy because Laos has one of the highest levels of ethnic diversity in Asia. Only about 50% of the population is ethnic Lao. But like China and unlike Thailand, the Lao government from the start has given every member of the multi-ethnic state official recognition and membership to the nation. And this is stated very clearly in the constitution. There's a strong emphasis on equality of ethnic groups and non-discrimination and solidarity. And really, most Lao people are aware of this. So on the one hand, the Laos is being committed to maintain this ethnic equality and traditions of each ethnic group. On the other hand, the government puts strong emphasis on national development and the adoption of a progressive and universal cultural policy, and the two sometimes can be somewhat in tension. Anyway, in terms of development, these policies towards the minority have aimed at expanding education, healthcare, social welfare, and in the case of Highlanders in particular, they try to stop shifting cultivation. Now, I've seen some of the effects of these policies in my village when I was there last year. Due to the remoteness of the place, these changes have occurred only in the past 10 to 15 years. With the help of an NGO, the government has built a road, and so Aka can go to the lowlands, they can access the market, they can buy new commodities like clothes. So they don't make their own clothes anymore to the extent that they used to do before. They've built a secondary school, the police station. They have eradicated malaria from the lowlands. Before, they wouldn't dare to go to the lowlands. Now they go. So there's been a lot more integration. Also, the government discouraged some Aka customs that were considered backward and not in line with the moral code of the Lao. Also, they have attenuated some festivals. They reduced the number of days because they were deemed to be too expensive. This is a photo of a festival. They've not stopped shifting cultivation yet because it's hard to find cash crops as a substitute. But overall, this change has meant a lot of unprecedented integration with lowlanders. I've had the effects of making highlanders much more similar to lowlanders than in the past. Now, how all this is happening is very complex. As one might expect, given the aquacultural emphasis on maintaining a boundary between the inside and the outside, some of these efforts of integration are met with resistance. Sometimes, however, the aka willingly accept these changes because they benefit from them. It's very complicated. It's never a matter of assimilation to the lowland. It's never a matter of tradition giving way to modernity. It's more complex. But anyway, now the aka are aware that they have dropped some traditional customs and they've taken on Lao customs. And in line with the performative idea of identity, now they even say that the aka now are 20% Lao. So the question is, will it ever become 100% Lao? It's an interesting question because in other countries, aka in Thailand or China, for example, they don't identify themselves as Thai or Chinese anymore. They don't identify themselves as aka anymore, but as Thai or Chinese. And some in Laos, even some ethnic groups that are geographically close to the Lao, they have gone through a process of ethnic conversion. They have become Lao, according to by their own terms. But I think in case of the aka, there are some limits to it. The first is the language. They don't speak Lao yet. Only people who make it to secondary school, which are very few, can speak Lao. They still practice shifty cultivation. They have a lot of pride in their customs, and so they're not easily giving away to new customs. And another factor that seemingly halts assimilation is the emergence of a transnational idea of ethnic identity in neighboring countries. So some aka in Thailand, in Myanmar, and China are trying to create a solid network with the purpose of cementing the idea and aka sense of belonging or connection across the five countries. And they're doing this with new media, they are doing CD, they're making new songs, they're making DVD about aka history. And the aka in Laos really buy a lot of this stuff from the market. They also hold conferences like this in China. The aka in Laos, however, they're limited in participating in this kind of new emergence of aka identity because they don't have money to travel, and also the Lao state is sometimes suspicious of who comes of this aka spoke person because they might be a fellow aka, but they might also be missionaries, and the Lao has adopted a strong stance against proletization. So overall, aka identity as of now has not been challenged very much in Laos. However, it is expected to change very soon with integration development policies increasing. So for this perspective, it's interesting to look at what happened to the aka in Thailand and China. And this aka in Thailand and China have gone through very different into very different trajectories depending on the state they happen to be in. So in Thailand, like Laos, from the start, the government has never guaranteed citizenship to ethnic minorities. The ethnic minorities were excluded on the basis that they could not speak Thai, on the basis that they were not Buddhist, and they never heard of the king. And they were actually seen as a threat to the nation. And the state, not recognizing them as indigenous, appropriated their land. The government turned a lot of rice fields into rubber, tea, or coffee plantations. And so from very early on, they shifted from being subsistence farmer into wage laborers, farmers. And this disrupted aka customs to a great extent because aka customs were embedded into the cycle of shifting cultivation. And in Thailand, really, the ethnic component has been relegated to a very narrow sphere of social life, like dress, music, but nothing else. And also, the early involvement in the market economy created a lot of wealth disparities. So some people got very rich, some people got very poor. And this has never happened before in aka history. And Christian missionaries really capitalized on that. Aka in Thailand went through a lot of huge waves of conversion because poor people could become Christians. In China, things have been very different. Like Laos, the Chinese government has granted citizenship to ethnic minorities from the beginning, since when Mao came to power. However, these minorities were sorted into various stages of human progress. And the aka, with their so-called primitive mode of production, were considered the most backward of all, and they were supposed to be helped by the Han Chinese, who were considered the bearers of civilization. In terms of custom, the Chinese state eradicated all customs considered superstitious, so all the ritual, the big ritual life that the aka held was completely eliminated. Also, with the Deng era around the mid-80s, all the ban on practicing customs were lifted but were never fully recovered. And as of now, while the Chinese state boasts that its ethnic policies allow minorities to perform their role as masters in the country, in reality, this has only been to the extent in which they've been imitating the Han Chinese. So identity and ethnicity in China have been reduced to the politically acceptable. An anthropologist who worked both with Yaka in Thailand and China, Janet Sturgeon, said that the Yaka in Thailand went through a process of marginalization through exclusion, whereas the Yaka in China went through a process of marginalization through inclusion. And by way of conclusion, I can say that the situation in Laos bears more similarity with the Chinese case, but in Laos, the government has been much more receptive towards ethnic minority, towards the needs and the ethos of ethnic minorities. And so I can say that as of now, I mean, nobody's knows what will happen with the Yaka in the next 20 or even 5 years, but they look to be set on a path towards further integration that will probably reserve them less trouble and less direct challenge to their idea of identity. That's it.
Okay. All right. So I would like to invite Dorothy Ferrari, who is a PhD student at UCL, to give some comments.
Thank you. I think from all the presentations, we can see a clear picture of exclusion and the vulnerable position of the marginalized group in various countries in Southeast Asia. And though they are being excluded, yet it seems that the government failed to protect, to provide, and to include them in the development, the national development agenda. And not only that, I think not only failed to protect it, its people, the country seems, the government seems to be one of the barriers for their inclusion in economics, politics, and social activities, such as the one that we look at to the case in children migrant in Sabah. So I have a very basic question, actually. How could we insert the marginalized group issues in national discourse, and who do you think should take the active role in promoting their well-being? Thank you.
So, do panelists get a chance to answer?
Okay. All right, go ahead.
Me. It's really interesting. I mean, in Malaysia, the federal government actually is quite keen to improve the rights of these children, but continually comes up against the problem of, you know, the Sabah problem. Some of you might know about the IC project. This was something which had been alleged to have happened throughout the kind of 80s and 90s, whereby Muslim immigrants in Sabah were given fast-track citizenship in order that they would bolster UMNO support. And someone earlier was, I think it was Mustafa, was talking about, you know, the East Malaysian role in upholding UMNO in Malaysia. So then this is a huge issue for people in Sabah and makes them very resistant to giving any kind of rights, even birth certificates, to children. There was a big discussion about what do we do about statelessness, you know, let's have a better way of registering births. And it was kind of like, no, these children shouldn't even get that. We'll just give them a record of birth. So, you know, they can't even have a proper birth certificate. So I think in Malaysia, the federal government is conducive to, you know, interested in improving the rights of these children, but the state government won't.
Oh, I'm going down the line. I think the state's immediate impulse when confronted by the types of cases that I've shared with you today is to enforce human rights regulations, whether it's based on IPRA, which is the national law for indigenous peoples, or international humanitarian law in international law. That is problematic, however, as was mentioned earlier, I was a lawyer before I became an anthropologist, and I've never been particularly enamored of human rights work, especially because I keep seeing it violated on a day-to-day basis. It's not a very good career. So my point is that human rights enforcement is very problematic. In the Philippines, there was this Stop Lumad Killings campaign, Stop Aboriginal Killings, if you translate Lumad, no? And a lot of questions were coming out about who do you turn to when the people who are killing you wear the badge? So it's very problematic in terms of enforcing it, especially in a context where sometimes the state itself is associated with the violations. So yes, I would push for more human rights enforcement, but I recognize the problematics of this kind of response. The other response, I think, is to go the direction of the Bangsamoro Basic Law negotiations between the State of the Philippines and the Moro Islamic Liberation Front. And they actually came up with a charter, no, for an autonomous region for Muslim Filipinos in southern Philippines. My critique immediately after that came out was, if it's good enough for the Muslim Filipinos, why shouldn't it be applied for non-Muslim animist groups also in the Philippines? So I am hoping for a dialogue on what does it mean to be indigenous and Filipino within the context of the emerging or Philippine nation state, particularly along the lines of human rights violations, land and resource rights, and maybe autonomy between the state and indigenous peoples.
Thank you. I think the classic human rights answer will be it's the responsibility of the state and the obligation of the state, and also that failing which, then civil society needs to step up, you know. But I think what worries me increasingly is that in the issues that we've talked about today, we have uncivil society. You know, we've got community groups and mobs and everyday people who are challenging these very rights and are not standing up for them. And I think for some of these rights, like even LGBT rights and some women's rights, the mainstream human rights community don't necessarily support these rights either. So that's the troubling thing.
Okay, well, thank you very much. So now we have about, 30 minutes left. Wow. So I would like to... I would like to take a few questions and then let our panelists have a chance to answer. In the back, please. If you could introduce yourself, that'd be great.
Hi, I'm Carlo. I'm a master's student studying here at the LSE. My question is for Professor Gatmaitan. Considering our new president-elect is Hart Manobo, how do you see their status in our country advance? And if you could identify a few key things or key pointers that indigenous peoples or the government could do in order to give indigenous peoples ownership over economic development, what would they be?
Are there other questions? Okay, boom.
Okay. Yes, Duterte. I don't think he has been declared as the winner yet, but all the other contenders have ceded the race. So I think it's a moot point. On the one hand, I live in Davao City, where Duterte comes from, and he has a very loyal following among indigenous groups within the city. Which bodes well in the sense that he is aware of the situation of indigenous peoples. In fact, he's well-connected with the military as well as the communist NPA, because I think that's one way he is able to balance out problems that arise affecting indigenous peoples. For example, recently there was a group of indigenous peoples who evacuated to Davao City, and they set themselves up in a church, I think. And Mayor Duterte was very active in trying to create a safe space for them within the city. In fact, it's becoming a problem because other indigenous peoples is trying to escape from militarization are going to Davao City. Now, they're seeing it as a haven for indigenous groups. On the other hand, Duterte has also a very paternal attitude towards indigenous groups. And in fact, some people accuse him of using the indigenous peoples as a election tool. It's a way of cultivating votes in the highland parts of Davao City. The last point is that Duterte is in favor of federalism, which is a possible way of reconciling the notion of the Philippine nation-state with the multi-ethnic character of the Philippine population. I don't know what exactly he plans to do in order to achieve this federalism, but a lot of people are looking at this as a possible solution to these kinds of internecine, constant ethnic/economic conflicts between uplanders and lowlanders, rich people versus poor people. In terms of the laws, we already have in the Philippines, in Southeast Asia, we are the only ones, we're the only country with a clear law that actually provides for titling of ancestral lands and domains. In fact, Indonesia and I think Malaysia, two or three other countries in ASEAN have been going to the Philippines, talking to the lawyers there, asking how effective was this whole thing. And on one hand, more than 1 million hectares of indigenous lands have been titled. So that's on the plus side. On the other side, however, the emphasis has always been on what you gain from titling. Basically, you get the documents of title attesting to your ownership. What has not been considered in the whole history of the indigenous people's movement in the Philippines is what you have lost through the titling process, which is state reconnaissance, state monitoring of your movements, of your transactions. And in a way, it is a way of commodifying ancestral lands because it's titled already. Previous to the IPRA, if you want to take over land, you have to talk to every one family. But once it is titled, all you have to talk is to that one person under whose name the title has been issued. So it simplifies the whole process of economic exploitation. So there are pros and cons with this whole process of land titling. My own take is that we can still tighten the IPRA law. I think there's no way to say, finally, no, we reject titling. Because titling, at least under the Philippine legal system, is the strongest evidence of ownership. So I don't think you'll get indigenous peoples backing you up in a rejection of the IPRA. The way forward, therefore, is to strengthen or try to reinforce the IPRA law. My critique of the IPRA law has that it's been a very anthropologically naive set of policies. It doesn't consider the fact that indigenous peoples are fluid groups, communities are negotiated rather than fixed. It doesn't consider economic factors when they started issuing the titles. These various weaknesses have to be addressed in order to improve the situation of indigenous peoples.
So we'll take two questions.
Yeah, my name's Seb Rumsby. I'm studying at Warwick University for my PhD. I've got a question for Giulio. Thanks for your talk. It was really interesting to hear a perspective from the periphery about what is included for them and what is excluded for them, including the lowlands. I just was wondering, is there any kind of... you said there was a kind of transnational ACA identity that was beginning to form. Was there any kind of sense that you got from a kind of common experience of marginalization from other ethnic minorities within Lao, and whether any of them kind of communicated with each other, or are the other ethnic minorities also excluded from the ACA identity?
Okay. All right. One more question.
Hi, I'm Gusika. I'm Indonesian, and I'm currently studying a BA in War Studies at King's College London. And I have a question I guess it could be directed to anyone. 3 years ago, I was interning in UNESCO, and I learned that Indonesia doesn't recognize the word indigenous, because technically 95% of Indonesians are native to Indonesia. So like even I would be considered Indonesian. So the Indonesian word for indigenous is pribumi, and I'm also pribumi. And so I guess that could like pose any pose problems internationally in terms of policy. So I want to ask, what would you think is a good solution for Indonesia, I guess? And because obviously, like, the government would probably not work with any NGOs or activists that use the word indigenous because they don't acknowledge it. And how important is the usage of the word itself, and would you suggest, like, any alternatives to the word? Thank you.
Yes, so the question was about the transnational idea of identity among the Akka that is emerging now. Akka, I've happened to meet Akka from Thailand and China, and their experience is that they are aware that they've been excluded from the state, I mean, both in China, in the past, a lot, much more than they are in Laos. And so they have been deprived of their customs through Christian proselytization and the eradication of custom from government. And so the idea of creating this this transnational idea of identity is that, I mean, is that sort of rediscovering of the Akka roots and the sharing of it throughout the five countries. I mean, it's a project that's met always a lot of difficulties because they don't have money. I've never been to China. I've only met Akka in China very few times, so I don't have a comprehensive idea of it, but this is my impression. And in terms of other ethnic groups, other ethnic groups, highland groups, there are many ethnic groups that live in other countries as well. In the past, they've traveled even more to other countries than the Akka. For example, the Kamu people used to travel in Thailand every season. And so they are all groups that are, now I don't know their realities, but they are all trying at the moment to establish this sense of connections among countries. And the Akka in particular, because they have such a great tradition of myths and history of genealogies, this is quite, for them important to do. Perhaps in less, with other minorities is not done to the same extent. But, this is what Yak.
Anyone want to answer questions about...
You can do the pre-boomy one.
Well, it's funny because I'm an anthropologist, so normally I should be kind of pro-uses of the word indigenous and pro-indigenous people, but having done research in Sabah, you really see the negative side of this total constant emphasis on indigeneity, whereby, children who are third generation, born in Sabah, speaking Sabah and Malay, are like termed foreigners. And what I found interesting was often the people on the ground running alternative learning centres for children, there were quite a lot of Malaysian Chinese living in Sabah who were running these centres, and some of them would explicitly say to me, we're migrants as well. It's just we were migrants a really long time ago and we were lucky enough to be here when we got, when Malaysia was founded and we got citizenship. So I know I'm not really answering the question, but it's kind of interesting when indigenous is a sort of helpful term, and there's a big debate in anthropology about it, and when it becomes a really, really problematic term, which is basically saying, if you were here at X time, you're somehow more authentic and real, and you have this connection to the land that other people don't have. And obviously in Malaysia, the whole Bumiputra policy, which is, incredibly contested now, is founded on a quite difficult a notion of indigeneity, which doesn't really work for this country formed through migration.
Yeah.
Yeah, I was just going to echo what you've said, but also I think indigenous is a power-laden term, because when you define someone as indigenous, you define other people as non-indigenous, as migrants, therefore. I think what is interesting in the case of Malaysia is that Orang Asli, the Aboriginal groups, disrupt the Bumiputra claims that Malays have. And also, it is a long, complicated story, but then there are multiple waves of Malay Muslims as well, and at a certain point, they weren't all Muslims. You can see the politics of the term.
Thank you. So two questions. One to Catherine. Could you just eliminate the, I mean, what would be the lobbies in Sabah against giving people full citizenship rights? I mean, is it simply electoral advantage? Is it a kind of general racism? Is it factory owners that want a supply of casual labour? I mean, are these all factors in the decision? And to Julio, is in Laos, are the Akha, because in China you have the official 56 ethnic minorities. Vietnam decided it couldn't have more than China, so it only had 54. Are there only 52 in Laos or something? And are Akha one of them?
Thank you. There is some straightforward racism, particularly against Muslim Filipinos, partly because of security issues in that region, the Lahad Datu incident in 2013, the ongoing claim, because Sabah was part of the Sultanate of Sulu, that it's somehow part of the Philippines. So there is a lot of anti-Filipino prejudice. Even though, of course, many there are ethnic groups who straddle the borders. And so there's also that discourse about the enemy within, you know, someone who's Suluk, even if they've got Malaysian citizenship, what do we know about them? And economically, yeah, I mean, lots of people have written about how undocumented migrants, they're great. They're a fantastic source of cheap labour because they have no rights, you know, and they're incredibly insecure and you can just lay them off when you don't need them anymore. And, you know, I knew families who lived in workers' housing attached to, like, chicken farms, or the chicken farm that was in the photo, and it was just the father who was paid, and the family get a house, and they get free water and electricity. And they basically all, these are seven kids in this family, they all end up working in the chicken farm because they're grateful to the owner, because he provides them with this accommodation and tips people off if the police come, or pays. There are some factory owners who constantly just bribe the police to stay away because it's actually very expensive for employers to regularise their workers. So, yeah, definitely it. There's another side to the story, which is that economically it works. And then, yeah, the political thing, the problem about... There's a sort of whole discourse about demographic change. And I think that's why it's interesting why children, who often in many contexts are the innocents who people feel sorry for, in this context, children, they're the time bomb of the future. They're like, you know, this is the demographic change which is going to explode. Mm. And Sabah is... There's constant references to how many people were indigenous in, you know, in 1963, and now how the Kadazan or Murut or Dusun population has gone right down. So, yeah, there's lots of different factors.
Well, the question about Laos, the Lao government recognizes 49 ethnic groups. There was 47 until 2005, and then they got upgraded.
It's a good answer.
Thank you. I'm Sayyed Khan, ambassador of Laos to the UK. I thought I was going to wait until my next round, but I have found out that the four of your presentation are very important, very useful. Of course, and in ASEAN, we know that we should not lecture the others to come up with a constitution. You have to do like that. But actually, in my country, just like Ungaro just said, that we have our own history, combining with many ethnics, 49, as you said. Because the reason why we have discovered more ethnics, because there have been studies to see the difference between different ethnics. That's why there are two more have been identified as different from the others. So we are happy to have more. because Laos is a country where we just like we like to see a melting pot in the whole country. What we are looking for is a peaceful, stable country rather than asking them to change their identity. What we are very sensible, very sensitive is to become extremists. to try to form up a separatist movement. That is the only main concern of the government. We promote them. We like them to keep their identity because that's one of the selling points of Laos. Tourists like to see the ethnic cities in the whole country when they come. They don't want to see the uniform in the whole country. It's beautiful to see different. Many people go, for example, many people go to Japan. They were looking for the ethnics. The Aino nearly disappear. I went to Hokkaido. I tried to ask them, how many of you can speak Aino language? None. So and, this is what is happening in my country. That's why I really appreciate Onkaro on helping Laos to be more visible in this room, at least.
Put him on your panel.
Our driver, I was working when I was working in New York. One of our drivers was asked by his colleagues at the UN, "Where are you from?" "From Laos." "Oh, Lagos, Nigeria." We know that. Now you know more Laos. Thank you very much.
I'm not sure I have a question or comment or wishful thinking. And as I listen through to you, there's so many things that tied up with RCM value, right? Exclusion, inclusion, human rights violation, and still as less sharing, right? So this is not only confined into Sabah. So, for example, there are millions of children born in Thailand and Malaysia being born still as less. Mm. And they are also second, third generation. Mm-hmm. And they are by no means, they don't speak Burmese language. They don't want to go back to Burma. And they have no birth registration certificate because they were born in a refugee clinic set up by a refugee woman. So they have a list of records. Mm. But there is nothing. So these children are accounting more than a million. And when I went to was in Burma, I actually spoke to head of the ILO, another civil society and government in Myanmar, and I don't want to name it, and nobody want them to come back. Nobody. Because they think that we cannot solve the problem inside Burma yet. How do we solve the problem of outside? Mm. So this is really interesting. That also made me think about, double standard of ASEAN, right? In one world, one way we are talking about ASEAN, where we are Asian, right? So whenever we talk about it, we use this word, we are Asian, right? We actually, kind and generous and but on the other hand, we are the one that creating. So what are so this solution, if we want to be strengthened of ASEAN value, one could be thinking about human rights issue of status less, an inclusion. All that be really one such a way that we can actually make a difference in regional development, peace, and economic sustainability. Because we all know that migrant community, undocumented migrants, are the lower ranks of every society. Mm. And they are, this morning also we say 65-70% of them are stuck in the seafood industry and at the corner of factory, that there's no guarantee of their health, safety, education, and future. Mm. And these children are leading to the disaster consequence. They are actually risking HIV, AIDS, and all kind of, health and safety things. So maybe that's why I'm saying that I don't have a question. I don't have a comment. I just wish for thinking. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Other questions? Okay, back there.
I'm also from Warwick. But my question's, I guess, more personal, I think. And I don't know whether it's a question or a comment again. So we were talking about identity just now. Bilo talked about how the minorities in Laos do consider themselves Laotian in the end. And I think His Excellency did say that he went to Japan and found some minorities who could not speak their own language. So I also have this problem with myself, actually, because I'm from Singapore. I was asked like multiple times, do you speak Malay, do you speak Cantonese, Hokkien? I don't speak any of them, even though they're all my mother tongues, technically. So my question is really whether, for the others on the panel, do these minorities consider themselves part of the country? Or if they consider themselves part of the country, do they think themselves as a different society? Or not necessarily like at contesting like the national sovereignty or whatnot, but as a case of like, do they consider themselves a different ethnic lot or linguistic lot, I guess. Yeah.
So the as I said that the children I work with are really heterogeneous, so there's a really mixed bag of responses to that. There's a big difference between the children of Filipino refugees and migrants and the children of Indonesian migrants, because the Filipinos do not want to go back ever to the Philippines, and many of the children have never been there, and they think it's a place full of ghosts because of the war. So many people were killed there. They've heard all these stories. So, and I want some, you know, when you do research with children, you have to be very sensitive and try and find out their perspectives on things. And I remember talking to this little boy about where he might be from, you know, trying to find out his ethnic identity, and he just looked at me and he said, "Saya orang di sini," you know, "I'm a person from here." And I thought that was great, and I always come back to that when I start talking about their identity. Like, for him, he was a person from there. Just stop assuming I'm a foreigner, you know, I'm a person from here. But some of the children of Indonesians, their parents have a complete desire to return home, even though they've been in Sabah for 35 years, and they've become gradually more and more impoverished as being a migrant has become more and more expensive. The communities they left in Adonara or Lembata have developed, but they haven't. So there's a kind of shame in being a migrant who didn't make it. So it's hard to go home. But these children have always been told they're going to go home. So they, and some of them study in an Indonesian school, so they feel Indonesian. But it, so in a way, it's kind of harder for them. But also, my first research was in Flores, a group of people called Manggarai, and they didn't really think of themselves as Indonesian. Mm. That was the people in Jakarta. So I think even within, you know, populations who haven't migrated, it's complex. So don't worry what you speak. You know.
I think you raise one issue that we haven't really fully delved into, and that's the salience of ethno-nationalism in Southeast Asia. And I think that we're comfortable with an ASEAN identity where we maintain our own national identity.
Yeah.
But we struggle to think or imagine how a Thai person could be a Malaysian or a Filipino could be a Cambodian or, you know, like we think, okay, these are all 10 countries, stay in your country, stay in your territorial boundary, you know. So I wish there was a Southeast Asia where that was possible, you know, but they weren't so stuck on a dominant narrative about what a national identity is, that we could move more between each other. But we still are that way, and we are proud of it in a sense, you know. So it gives you a sense of identity, but it also excludes, and for the people excluded, it is very destructive.
Speaking for indigenous peoples in the Philippines, no, secession has never been an issue for indigenous peoples. In other words, they never saw themselves as apart from the Philippine state. The only groups that actually advocated secession were Moro National Liberation Front and later on Moro Islamic Liberation Front. And in both cases, they initially took on a secessionist stance, but later on they surrendered that line and adopted an autonomy framework. So the success of secession, breaking away from the state as a political program, is not very successful in the Philippines. And I think that's true not just for Muslim groups, but also for animist non-Muslim groups in the Philippines, the ones I work with. I think it's not a question of whether or not we are part of the Philippine polity. It is what are the relationships, what are the obligations and rights of us as indigenous groups in relation to the Philippine state. So it's a nuancing, as it were, it's a fine-tuning of the relationships between indigenous groups and the national groups. Autonomy, regional autonomy, might be one mechanism for achieving this, but we're not there yet.
Well, yeah, I can say something about secession in Laos. the ACA, there's never been a case of the ACA trying to engage in separatist movement through recorded history. This is because they are very egalitarian and they really never tend to organize around a single leader who can make this happen, at least in recorded history, then who knows in the past. But there are other ethnic groups who have done this. For example, the Hmong have managed to organize around Eliza and setting into motion separatist movements, but they have never been able to do that in Laos. And now I think it's petered out. It's no more.
I wanted to add one thing, partly because of what you were saying about the Asian values that sound fantastic but don't kind of translate in practice. I mean, Sabah is a really interesting place for that because Sabahans continually talk about how they're not like uptight peninsular Malaysians, right? Muslims and Christians can eat together, everything's chilled and relaxed in Sabah. It's a cosmopolitan place. But the migrants, so it's exactly that. It's like actually all of those Sulug, Cagayan, Ubian, Bhutanese kids could totally contribute to that sense of Sabah as a multicultural cosmopolitan place, which is what makes it distinctive and different to the peninsula. But, yeah, these kind of ethno-nationalist discourses stop that happening.
Anyone last questions or comments? Okay, in the back of the room.
Thank you. My name is Zila, and I'm a master's student here. My question is Dr. Catherine, and I'm proud to say I'm Sabahan. I'm from and I belong to the largest indigenous group in Sabah, Dusun. And my question is, you were addressing about the issue how Malaysian government refused to recognize the people, even though they are the second generations. They have been in Sabah. They introduce themselves as being, they belong to Sabah, but how about the existing gap between those who would consider themselves belong to Sabah and also the indigenous people, for example, the Dusuns? Because I grew up being told that there are two different groups in Sabah, and to a certain extent, we address them as Pilaks, meaning to say they don't belong to Sabah at all. So what is your comment on the gap between the local people as well as the group that, classified as the outsiders? Yeah, thank you.
It's incredibly profound. I think educational exclusion is going to make this gap even greater. I had a Malay teacher in KK who was... She was basically stateless, but she's now got a red IC. But she, her father was Filipino and her mother was Indonesian, and they met in Sabah. But she grew up in Lahad Datu and went to school at a time when the regulations were much more relaxed. And so she has Dusun friends, right? She has a network of friends who do not accept this idea that there are the, that there are the insiders and there are these awful, Pilaks. I mean, it's a terrible word that's used with reference to Filipinos often. And so I think now, kids are not going to school with those, there's not that kind of mixing. People aren't living together, really. If migrant workers are living in these workers' housing, there are very few spaces where that mixing can take place, and I think that's really problematic, and that leads to a greater sense of kind of us and them rather than actually my childhood friend who I'm supposed to call a Pilak, but, she's my childhood friend and I know she's it's a classic story of migration everywhere, I guess. The more, the more mixing there is of people and kids going to school together, the more they see similarities as and see differences as non-threatening. Mm. So... I think that's sort of basically the way to do it is to let the kids go to school. I think I just don't understand this educational exclusion. It's such an extreme policy, and it leads to all kinds of crazy strategies in families for getting documents illegally, borrowing birth certificates, buying the birth certificates of dead children, so your child can go to school, and then the kids go to school and they play down their ethnic identity. So I met a boy whose parents are from the Philippines originally and who was now studying in a Filipino learning center. And he said, this is the first place I've ever been able to say I'm Filipino.
ethnically, because before to have said that in a Malaysian school would have just been, you know, that's like saying you're dirt.
Okay, well, thank you so much. So before, can I have 1 minute just to wrap up? Mm. So there's a two key takeaway points. So I started my, at the beginning of this panel, I was talking about the key questions that sort of driving this panel is who are excluded and included and why and what mechanism through which they are being excluded, right? So the four panelists have shown us that this is a very complex issue, and unfortunately state play a big role in systematically marginalized groups of people. And so I hope you would agree with me as a role for us as a researchers that there's a lot of work for us to do in terms of trying to quantify as well as qualify these issues and try to disentangle the mechanism through which the exclusion process taking place in our region. Thank you. Mm-hmm.